Welcome to Inside the Rope, the podcast where we speak to the leading minds in wealth management. I'm your host, David Clark. In this episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Craig Colley of Regal Funds Management. Those of you who are keen listeners to the podcast will recognise Craig's name as being our guest on episode 77. So those people who want to hear more about his background and his job in investing in the healthcare area, I encourage you to listen to episode 77. In this episode, we concentrate and have a conversation on this new category of drug that's come about through the proliferation of Ozempic, GLP-1, and that category of weight loss drugs that is taking the market by storm. I think one of the telling pieces of data that Craig advises in the podcast is that it has the potential, this category of drugs, to become a drug or a group of drugs 7 times larger in terms of sales than any other drug currently in the market. If somewhere in the order of the US market adopts to about a 10% to 20%, say 15% take up of US people who are obese take up the drug, you could lead to that 7 times larger. So a huge potential market size for this drug, which seems to have huge positive secondary effects. Please enjoy the podcast. I know I certainly did. Remember to listen to the disclaimer at the end of the episode and that the podcast is recorded for informational and entertainment purposes only. People are always encouraged to receive their own advice and read disclaimer documents such as PDSs or information memorandums where needed. Please do, however, continue to send me your feedback. You can email me at david.clark@codacapital.com. Enjoy the episode. Craig Colley, welcome back to Inside the Rope.
Thanks, David. Great to be back.
Perhaps just for a reminder, I know you're in a previous episode, which I'll reference in the introduction. Perhaps you could just give listeners a bit of an introduction to yourself.
Sure. So I run a fund at Regal Funds Management. It's called the Long Short Healthcare Asia Healthcare Fund. We're running about $150 million right now. The strategy was launched to external investors beginning of 2022, and returns have been great, well ahead of the Asia Pacific MSCI index, which is probably the closest proxy to our universe. I run the fund along with a colleague of mine, Dilshan Senavaretna. Dilshan's based in Singapore. I'm based in Australia. We're both medical doctors by background, and the interesting thing about what we do is that Asia healthcare market generally is relatively inefficient. Mm-hmm. So unlike the US and Europe, where healthcare is a huge sector, I think it's actually the second biggest sector in the US behind tech, and it's actually the biggest sector in Europe. So in US and Europe, there's a lot of technically trained experts such as myself. So Dilshan and I are both medical doctors by background. But in Asia, where healthcare is a smaller emerging sector, there is really a dearth of experts, and a lot of people covering the sector, both sell side and buy side, come from like an accounting background rather than a medical science background. So that's our edge, and we see a lot of inefficiencies because of that, which is great for the fund returns.
Well, terrific. It's interesting. I had Phil King and listeners to the podcast, and people in financial markets will be well aware of Phil is and Phil's background, and Regal for that matter is one of Australia's leading hedge funds. It's interesting, Phil talks about wanting to create Regal into the Real Madrid, or actually I think he uses Barcelona as his example of the world, in that all the best football / soccer players here in Australia want to play for Barcelona, and Barcelona continues to be the best or one of the best in the world because all the best want to play there. So it was interesting this morning, I was thinking, I wonder who that makes you, because I think Phil, when I spoke to him about this, sees himself as the Lionel Messi who loves to still play the game, and I don't think he'll ever get that out of his system. As long as he draws breath, he'll always have his head in trades and transactions and positions in investments. I don't think he's ever going to step to the actual manager role into the dugout. I guess that makes you a winger or someone, one of the forwards up front or so forth. I don't know that the players well enough in the Barcelona team, but there you go. It's wonderful. And now, with your medical background and your investment lens on particularly, I thought it would be great to have a conversation with you about this trend that we've seen. I think most people, I live in Sydney, and I think there's a group of mothers, is the first way I've come across this, who have gotten hold of via social media, TikTok, anything else, and this, and by the brand name drug Ozempic. I thought it'd be great to talk with you about what is it, what it means for markets, what it means for investments, what are some of the, upside downsides, how might people want to think about their wealth management? So maybe if we could start off with, what is Ozempic?
Okay, so Ozempic is a branded medication which is part of the subclass of GLP-1 inhibitors or agonists. So this is a drug class which was actually first commercialized, I think, in 2006. Mm-hmm. And these medicines were found to help diabetics. So for diabetics with high blood sugar, it helps suppress people's appetite. It makes people feel fuller more quickly. So people end up ingesting less calories. That obviously has flow-on effects for your blood sugar. And what we've found out subsequent to 2006 can also have a lot of benefits for weight management.
And what's the upside of this type of drug? I take it's all about lowering people's body mass index, all of the health effects that come with losing weight. Would that be the correct way to think about it?
Yeah, that's right. So if you feel fuller more fast and it also delays your gastric emptying, then obviously the calories that you eat is significantly lower. As I mentioned, that helps your blood sugar. So if you're a type 2 diabetic, that can be very beneficial. But also it helps weight loss. And so they are probably the two direct impacts. But obviously weight loss is a huge driver for many other medical ailments. I think one estimate I saw recently is that 20% of all healthcare costs globally are related to obesity. So,
wow, that's a huge, when you play that out and you think about healthcare budgets around the world, Australia, the US, in Europe, if 20% are directly related to that, if you can have a meaningful shift in that, I think some of the numbers that you're seeing out of Ozempic are sort of 15% average weight loss. And then I think there's other variants they're talking about, maybe Wegovy and some other things that are a little bit even more successful than that. What, obviously, the big question there is, what are some of the downsides? What are some of the risks? Everybody's kind of, it's interesting, whenever I raise this discussion at the barbecue or the dinner table, you have some strong opinions very quickly. And then I don't know if it's a post-vaccine COVID world that all of a sudden people are, well, there's got to be some big downsides on things that are injected into you. And as you said, this was first invented in 2006, I believe. But what are some of the downsides or negative things that come along or side effects?
Yeah, generally the overarching thing I'd say is that actually these drugs look very safe. So they've been used for more than 15 years. And so a lot of people have taken them over a long period of time. The incidence of side effects is relatively minimal. The most common is nausea, diarrhea, and vomiting. Mm-hmm. So that's often obviously related. If your stomach's emptying much slower, you can't eat as much. People feel, sick and full, similar to what you would feel if you ate too much too quickly. So what tends to happen with these drugs is that they are started quite slowly. So a patient might, let's say they end up on a 50 milligram dose. Mm-hmm. It might be 10 milligrams for the first 2 weeks, then 15, then 20, then 25, et cetera. So it might take 3, 4, 5, 6 months before patients ramp up. And that's because their body and their habits and their mind needs to adjust to some of the nausea, feeling bloated and feeling full. But by and large, while most people have some of these symptoms early, it is not a deal breaker. So and the latest studies, if these things are titrated properly when people start them, you see compliance rates north of 90%.
Wow, that's amazing, because I think some of the things in the past has been that the original Ozempic or the first one's an injection that's taken once a week and people are a little reluctant for that. They forget about it then also. And I just want to check in with you on this, is that I think there's a point of conjecture between the layperson, the medical doctors, and analysts about how long people are going to be on this. When I the barbecue talk once again.
Mm.
People see this as, oh, I'm carrying a bit of weight in an Australian. Oh, yeah, I've got a little bit of extra weight and they're actually 100 kilos. So their BMI is probably 32, 33, 34. They're in the obese range. They think, oh, well, I can take this for 6 months a year, go down to 80 kilos, closer to a 25 BMI, and then they'll be off it. What's your view on whether people are going to be on it long term or whether they're going to be able to change their habits or they're going to go straight back to it?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing I'd say is that the people taking it right now are probably not the a representative sample of what the end state will be. I think a lot of people taking these drugs right now are taking them for lifestyle purposes. They're very hard to get hold of, and, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, at some other point in the podcast. But this huge – the supply constraints are massive right now. I think even Ozempic might still be on short supply in Australia. The companies did not forecast this sort of demand, and both Lilly and Novo are now saying that demand will significantly exceed supply at least for another 3 to 4 years. So right now, for various reasons, I think many people taking these drugs are maybe for lifestyle reasons. Maybe they have a wedding coming up. Maybe they want to look good on Instagram. But I think for that reason, the proportion of people taking them after 6 to 12 months is probably lower than what we'll see in the future.
Okay. So long term, you're a believer they're going to be on it for a longer period of time, or people are going to be able to use it for early and get off?
The data is still relatively early because the ramp up in the drugs is still, you know, in its very early stages. But if you speak to the companies, Novo and Lilly, that they both anticipate compliance rates, 1 year compliance rates of north of 80%.
Yes. But then, and will people be on it for 10 years? Is this got the potential to be like a Crestor, or what do they call the group of drugs for cholesterol?
Statins. Yeah.
You know, this is why people are getting excited. It could be what they call a blockbuster super drug where people are on it for the rest of their life versus just 1 year or 6 months.
Yeah, that's a really important question. I think that's one of the challenges to sizing this market, right? So I think there's 130 million obese people in the US. There's currently only around 2 million people taking the drug right now. And I think a lot of people might not like the side effects, right? They might not like feeling nauseous and bloated. They might not, they might miss having the craving to have food. And even the food element here is also, and many people also felt with other things they enjoy, such as red wine or alcohol. So, you know, there are anecdotes of many people stopping the drugs because they enjoy having a beer or a wine, and when they're on the medication, they don't like it. So there's definitely going to be a dropout rate, but you got to remember that obesity, as I said, is a massive health problem. I think 42% of Americans are obese. As I mentioned, I think 20% of all healthcare spend globally is related to obesity. And in fact, obesity is also the leading cause of preventable death in the US, and the leading cause of disability and absenteeism. So there is a huge problem out there. Sure, I think a lot of the people, especially those maybe at the margin, right, who might not be overtly obese, might just be a little bit overweight, I think those people might, you know, decide the trade-off is actually better off being off these medications. But I think if you're obese and if you're overweight and you want to reduce the risk of having a heart attack, a stroke, developing cancer, osteoarthritis, Alzheimer's, all of these risk factors which obesity carries, then I think a lot of people will stay on the medication.
Let's just dig into that sort of total addressable market that you've touched on, because I think it's why, A, I wanted to have a podcast on it when it doesn't seem directly related to people's wealth management, because I think the second order effects and the third order effects could be very, very meaningful in years to come. You've quoted a couple of times there the amount of obese people in the world. The size of that market, you know, in the US and in Australia, if they come onto these sort of drugs, is just absolutely huge. You know, is this something you see as being purely US, or is this a total global type of phenomena that you're seeing?
Look, I think the US is always generally the first market to roll out. Prices are much higher in the US, and the general rule of thumb for pharmaceuticals is that the US market is roughly half the global market.
Okay.
Because prices are so much higher. And also these drugs are in such short supply, so the manufacturers are clearly directing them to the US, obviously, where you know the pricing is significantly higher. The other thing worth discussing is that right now, as you point out, these drugs are injected. Now, I'll say that the injectable pens are very easy. You can easily twist the dose, and it's simply a quick – it's like a pen device where you just tap the end with your thumb. So that's once a week, which most people find incredibly easy. But and I think this is one of the opportunities, there is a very exciting oral version, which is in phase 3 trials right now, discovered by a Japanese company called Chugai and licensed to Eli Lilly. And I think that could have some meaningful implications in the uptake rate. I think if you're obese, you've got, you know, serious heart disease, you need to reduce the risk of having another event, then you're probably, you know, the thought of injecting yourself once a week is probably not a big issue. However, if you're, you know, young, otherwise healthy, but you are obese, maybe the thought of an injection might be too much. So I think there is a large segment of the market who will prefer to have oral tablets. And we're likely to have the first oral in the next couple of years.
Okay. Can you talk to us a little bit about the regulatory framework around this and where those drugs have come from in line with that?
Yeah, sure. So the first medication launched in 2006 actually had a really short half-life, so it was quite difficult to administer. People had to inject themselves twice a day. So it was relatively onerous. But since then, these companies have created longer-acting molecules also that have fewer side effects. And so that's, I think, been a key uptake in terms of getting the public to use more of these medications. Sorry, David, I forgot the – lost my train of thought.
No. And the origin and the regulatory framework.
Oh, yeah, the regulatory framework. So initially they were approved in diabetes, and then these companies it became clear that there was a lot of weight loss benefits as well. So but the diabetes approval has been since 2006. I think the obesity approval only came through about a year ago in the US. Now, the interesting dynamic here is that CMS, which is Medicare in the US, which is the largest, I guess, it's a public insurer. It's the largest insurer, if you like. They have a rule that they cannot fund drugs that are directed solely at weight loss or weight gain or for anorexia. And so CMS doesn't cover these medications for weight loss. Many of the commercial insurers do, but because of the demand being so high and they have caution about their spend, they've introduced quite a few what are called step edits or provisions to limit the uptake. So, for example, you might have to have, you know, pre-existing heart disease plus obesity to get these drugs. And similarly, CMS, as I said, does not approve these drugs for weight loss alone. So what the companies are doing, interestingly, is that weight loss has been proven. As you mentioned, I think Ozempic has 15% weight loss. The newer agents actually have 25% body loss.
Wow.
Body mass loss, which is, yeah, quite phenomenal. But what the companies are now doing is that they're doing large studies looking at the benefit on these second order effects. So Novo had a study last year called the SELECT study, and that reduced people who do not have diabetes but are obese and are at high risk of having heart disease, reduce their risk of having a cardiac or stroke by 20%. So that is a phenomenal result.
Wow.
And similarly, Novo is also doing a study for kidney disease. That study was stopped early in October last year, and we haven't seen the full data yet, but it suggests that around 25% risk reduction in people at risk of developing chronic kidney disease. So these sort of numbers are phenomenal for a drug directly looking at these ailments. So to have a drug that works in obesity having second order magnitude benefits this high really is quite phenomenal. And it's a clever way for them to get around some of these onerous provisions that the CMS has in the US. And so I think it's very likely that they'll get approval for heart disease, chronic kidney disease, and relevant to ResMed here in Australia, also for sleep apnea. And that study's coming out in the next few months too.
Slight curveball here, and I'll take us back to Novo Nordisk and a little discussion about them in a moment. But you said CMS isn't able to fund or provide support for any weight loss drugs. Now, it's interesting because in doing some research on this, it seems that there is almost within the market and within society, a real divider about whether weight loss is a disease or whether it's something that people should be responsible for their own will. And you know, this is up to them to control the calories and the amount that they move, and they should be responsible for the outcomes for this. And I think there's been some high-profile pharmaceutical companies in the past where their CEOs have said, no, we're not in weight loss. And those companies that are associated with weight loss have been slightly more nefarious shysters and the kind of snake oil salesmen. Is there an element of that, you think, in society that this is working through?
Yeah, I think a little bit, but I think the scientific community is moving towards obesity as a disease, mm-hmm. Where it's obviously multifactorial, but it's less, I guess, you know, for lack of a better word, blame on the patient itself, and more attribution towards, you know, societal, I guess, pressures, the ease of getting high calorie food, habits, promotions, things like this. And so I think definitely moving towards obesity as a disease itself. But in some ways, I don't think it's going to matter, right? Because these studies, that the benefits of these second order effects are so large that I think these drugs are going to be widely approved for a whole swathe of indications, and so that don't actually, you know, need weight loss on its own for approval.
Okay. And have I got it right in my research that there's a company, Novo Nordisk, that was sort of came around in I think it's a Danish company in the 1920s with quite a philanthropic basis of to solve diabetes, and it was the inventor of insulin. And I think it's up until this date, its primary source of revenue has been insulin, and it created this drug Ozempic or this GLP group in 2006, and now it's rolling out for weight loss. Is that roughly right? And I think Ozempic, you know, it's a huge company at $530 billion, 15th largest company in the world and Europe's largest company. Is that sort of roughly right of the history and the profile of that business?
Yeah, that's right. Novo's always been a world leader in diabetes. Mm-hmm. And I believe it exactly as you say, that they were the first people to synthetically create insulin. But it's worth mentioning the second company, Eli Lilly. Mm-hmm. So that's an even bigger company. I think the market cap is 750 billion US, so north of a trillion Australian dollars. Those companies, between the two of them, you know, the market shares are probably evenly split right now. Lilly's got a drug in development. It's the 25% weight loss drug I mentioned, which looks like it's going to be the market leader, and also has an oral medication as well coming out.
And what's that called?
The
Lilly one? Is there a name for that?
Tirzepatide.
Tirzepatide, okay. Yeah. Where do they come up with these catchy names? Like,
yeah, it's that's a process in itself. But the growth is phenomenal. I think Lilly's, as I said, a huge company, but it's going to grow earnings, at least for analyst consensus, which has been, I think, continually upgraded over the last 2 to 3 years. Right now, consensus is sitting at 100% earnings growth, Lilly, next year.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think 60% the year after.
And is most of that based off these drugs?
Yes.
Okay, so you mentioned supplies being very constrained, and I'm hearing reports that some of these companies have gone ahead and built manufacturing facilities prior to final stage sign-off, which is really unusual. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you expect this to play out and the sort of timing and supply machinations around that?
Yeah, so I think management, it's sort of a double-edged sword, right? So it's not great to have your most profitable drug supply constrained, but it is a sign of just how massive demand is. I think broker consensus right now, as I said, if anything, it's probably a little bit conservative. So I think the growth rates in the next few years are going to be phenomenal. And I think one important aspect of that, as I mentioned, is the new oral drug. Mm-hmm. So what's the largest constraint for the medications right now is often the needles, the packaging glass, the self-injector pens. So to ramp up supply of those as quickly as demand is hoping for is very, very difficult. In fact, Novo, I think just 2 weeks ago, bought a contract manufacturing company called Catalent because it wants to repurpose all of that manufacturing capacity for its own drugs. So Catalent previously would have a bunch of clients that would help make their drugs. So, you know, they have probably a couple of dozen pharmaceutical companies, but Novo, in order to ease its supply constraints, has bought the whole company and will eventually repurpose that facility to help produce its own weight loss drugs. But the oral is a lot easier to manufacture, right? So if you're manufacturing a tablet, you don't need needles, you don't need glass vials, you don't need auto-injector pens, etc. You just need a pill press. And so if the oral drug gets approved in the next few years, and we think it will, then that could ramp up supply meaningfully and also help Lilly obviously gain a lot of market share.
And you believe it'll be as efficient or as effective as the non-oral version or the needle version?
I don't think it'll be quite as effective, but I don't think it needs to be. So I don't know if many people really want to lose 25% of their body weight.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people might start on the injections, maybe trying to lose a lot of weight, and then for maintenance therapy, they might switch to the oral.
Okay.
But I think a lot of people will probably just stay on the injectable. It's like once a week, you just have it in your bathroom at home, and some people might prefer that to actually dose in a tablet per day. It's sort of hard to know how it will fall out. I think if you speak to Novo, who have probably a less strong pipeline in terms of orals, they say the market will still be predominantly injections. Lilly, on the other hand, might say that it's more half-half or even maybe two-thirds the oral versus one-third the injection.
Okay, so when I think about this rolling out in my little mind, I think about, you know, side effects, number one, whether people are going to want to take it. It sounds from talking to you, you think that people are going to get over that and the technology and the information is going to prove that these are fine and we're going to see widespread adoption and people will get over that part of it. The second one is the actual physical supply of them, and it sounds like that's coming online over the next 2 to 3 years. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I think there'll be, you know, 30 to 50% growth in supply over the next 4 to 5 years.
Okay.
Each of those years.
And the third one I think of is cost. And I'm interested in this one. And you're talking about the US being such a big part of the world's healthcare medical expenditure. And I think of the US and, you know, I know a lot of my US friends and we've got a bunch of US listeners. We're very lucky here in Australia to have such a great medical system. I know when, you know, lots of Australians, we go to the US, the first thing we've got is our travel insurance, because if you get sick there, it turns out to be very expensive. But it also occurs to me that, you know, the way they're set up with their medical insurance doesn't help something like this, because if I'm right, most of their medical insurance is tied to their employer, and most people's employers turn over every 3 to 4 years, I think the data is. So if you're a medical insurer in the US, you're probably sitting there saying, well, why do I want to fund something that all the benefits and all the cost benefits are like 10, 15 years away in terms of they're not going to get diabetes, you're not going to have all these comorbidities, you're not going to have heart attack, stroke, all these wonderful secondary effects that you're talking about, but I'm not going to get that down the track. So I'm kind of thinking there's these roadblocks in the US that won't bring costs down. So can you talk to us a little bit about where the cost is at today and where you see that going in the future?
Yeah, so that's a very good point. I think, you know, this market is so large that I think a lot of the insurers and CMS, Medicare in the US are the same. They're looking at the potential ramp here and they're thinking, well, this could actually send us bust, right? Mm. So the traditional definition of a blockbuster drug is $1 million US sales per year.
Mm-hmm.
The largest drug so far ever is a drug called Humira, used mainly for cancer. That was a $20 billion drug. I think this category for obesity could be $150 billion. So that just gives you a sense of just how large this.
So just repeat that for us, please.
So just to give you a sense of the scale of how big this category could be,
mm-hmm.
The definition of a blockbuster drug is $1 billion US sales per year.
Yep.
The biggest drug ever, Humira, $20 billion US sales per year. I think the obesity category could be $150 billion.
Oh, wow. So we're talking, what's that, 7x multiple of the biggest
drug ever.
Ever. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Now, and actually the penetration that you need to get to for the obese population is not very high. At current prices, so they're about $10,000 per year, these drugs, in the US.
Mm-hmm.
At current prices, if you only get 10% penetration of the obese people in America, right? So there's 42 million obese people. Excuse me, 42%, which is 130 million.
Mm-hmm.
If you get to 4% of the US population, which is 10% of the obese people, or about $13 million, Then the cost in the US is around $80 billion. And if you use the standard rule of thumb of doubling the global market, it's going to be a $150 billion category. So it's a little bit scary for these insurers, right? They're looking at this huge potential cost blowout. But I think they're going to have to, right? In short, because the data from these studies is so powerful that I don't think they're going to have a choice. Now, a few things which are going to help them is that I think the price will come down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as Ozempic's patent expires maybe 2032, that's going to have implications for the other drugs. Obviously, the manufacturers will keep bringing out better, brighter drugs and try and switch patients to that. But I think that will help pricing. And the other thing which will help pricing is the oral medication. It's going to be a lot cheaper to produce. And I think the companies will still be able to derive a similar margin at a lower price.
Yeah, okay. We're building a picture here. So what do you think, now switching to our investments hat on, you know, with people thinking about their wealth management, you know, talking the first order, you know, is this something you think is priced fully into someone like Lilly and Novo Nordisk at the moment at current share prices? Or, you know, I think from our conversation today, you think the data has a hell of a lot more upside, is what I'm gaining from some of the things that you're saying.
Yeah, so, you know, we still own Lilly and we still own Novo. Also, Chugai Pharma in Japan is a large position for us. And so, look, the share prices have gone up a lot. I think Lilly's up 30% this year, and I think it was up maybe 60% last year. So the share prices have gone up a lot. Novo, I think, is up fourfold in the last 3 years. But consensus earnings upgrades still go up. And as I mentioned, I still think we're very early in the penetration curve for this class of medicine. So, look, we're looking a lot closer at Lilly and Novo now. We've owned them for more than a year, and I think some of the upside's beginning to be priced in. So we're still bullish on those, but perhaps not as bullish as we are on Chugai, where I think the upside is still significantly greater. And I think it's still less appreciated that Chugai did discover that oral molecule, which it licensed to Lilly. But yeah, we're still long the category. I think more difficult now is the second order effects, and you alluded to some of that before, but I think that's getting a little trickier. Like, is this priced into ResMed? Is this priced into some of the dialysis providers? That's getting a little bit tricky given some of the sharp moves we've seen on the downside there.
Let's dive into that. I think that's a fascinating place, because when you start to think of some of these things now, I've had one. I think I picked up a report the other day where Morgan Stanley may have said, look, if their forecasts play out, that someone like United Airlines ends up saving $80 million worth of fuel every year because their average plane is lighter if the take-up of this is as they see it. That to me is, you know, you talk about barbecue conversations, that's the one that gets people's attention, that, oh my heavens, is someone like Chipotle and GYG here, for instance, now saying, well, there's 70% less calories being consumed at lunch, we need to change our menus, you know, is everybody going to be buying Lululemon because they now fit into the black tights and want to wear them out? How are you thinking about some of these second order effects? We've seen a huge, you just flagged there, ResMed has had huge volatility because people are believing that there's going to be less people needing CPAP machines because there's going to be less obese people with sleep apnea. How are you thinking about those second order effects and or, you know, how you want to protect or benefit from those?
Yeah, look, it's been tricky. I think, you know, most healthcare investors have been aware of this category for, we've certainly been aware for several years. But I think a lot of generalist investors were caught maybe napping a little bit. And when the Novo Heart study I mentioned, the SELECT study came out middle or later last year, I think a lot of the generalist investors panicked and you saw this, you know, crazy sort of selling around some of these GLP-1 affected areas. Now, some of that volatility's reversed, and I think for ResMed, for example, it's recovered relatively well. But yeah, a couple of things I'd say about it is that one, the first one is that the ramp up's still going to be pretty slow, right? So I think, look, somewhere between 10 and 20% of obese people in America, I think that's sort of our assumption for where this market will get to. But it's probably going to take another 6, 7, 8 years to get there. So the ramp up's going to be very slow. And if you think of, you know, like Lululemon or fast food or McDonald's sales, obviously it's driven by the proportion of, I guess, obese people and their eating habits, which has been tracking up pretty gradually over the last 30 or 40 years. And still, in fact, the latest data suggests it's still going up. I think from that big picture macro view, probably the best way to think about it is actually that's probably not going to track up anymore. And if anything, it might start tracking down. Okay, so I think obese people in the US went from 35% to 42% over the last 20 years. So it's very gradual tailwind for these industries, which I think is going to turn into a gradual headwind. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the sky is falling down for a McDonald's or a fast food or confectionery manufacturer. So that's the first thing I'd say. But the second thing I'd say is that there are some sectors which are probably a little bit more exposed than others. We've already seen a couple of companies significantly affected. I think Jenny Craig, the weight loss company.
Is a big one. Yeah, I bumped into, I was having a conversation over at Manly at the Bower Cafe, and there was someone there who was telling me that one of the fellows there who likes to foil is a gastric banding surgeon with a house right on the front there. I'd suggest the gastric banding type of market might be restricted going forward. That would be the first one I would see as it's going to be tough.
Yep, gastric banding, and related to that, Intuitive Surgical is the surgical robot maker that said that its number of robot-assisted gastric procedures has been declining already. So there are some sectors like that. Your weight loss, Jenny Craig. I think Weight Watchers share price is down 90% in the last couple of years as well. Another one which I think is probably quite exposed is the kidney dialysis providers, so Fresenius Medical and DaVita. It's a European stock and a US stock. These tablets are effective in obesity, but what they're super, super effective is in diabetes. And the funding approval is much broader for diabetics. And the majority of patients who enter kidney failure and need dialysis, that's the main cause is diabetes. And so that one's a little bit earlier on the curve as well. ResMed and sleep apnea, that's an interesting one. I think there's definitely an overreaction there, and I think the share price has corrected on that. But, you know, the issue with CPAP is that it's actually a relatively clunky solution to a disease. So the idea of putting a mask on your face every night, data suggests that up to 50% of people simply can't tolerate it.
Yeah.
So it's difficult.
Compliance is very low.
Correct. And I think once you're on it, once you're used to it, you're often addicted, you know, forever because you actually feel so much better the next day because you've had a proper night's sleep. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, it's hard to get over that curve and it's hard to get used to the device. And I think a lot of people, especially those who are obese, which is the majority of sufferers of OSA, I think a lot of those people are going to try the weight loss medications first. Because taking a tablet once a day is a lot easier than getting used to wearing a medium to high pressure mask overnight.
Yeah. Interesting. Novo Nordisk, who sort of really at the heart of this and bringing it out, is a company that has really focused on serving diabetics. And it seems to me, in my mind, this is a little bit like when Kodak invented digital photography. Mm. Of course, they buried it because they didn't want to cannibalize their 35 mil business, which was the whole business. And in this case, Novo might, in fact, reduce the addressable clients, the size of their market for diabetics, because you have far, far fewer type 2 diabetics because there's far, you know, far, the benefits of people being on Ozempic. But I'm guessing here from what you're saying is that you think the net effect of that, i.e. the sales of the GLP-1 and this new category of drug, far, far outweighs the downside that they would suffer from cannibalizing themselves. But it's great that they've been able to, they're brave enough to do that, and that might have something to do with their sort of more not-for-profit origins and their sort of philanthropic benefits of the past there.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of that going on. Also, the sheer numbers just outweighed it, right? So we spoke about the US, 130 million obese people.
Yes.
In terms of type 2 diabetics, there's 38 million. But remember, insulin's mainly used in type 1 diabetics. Okay. I don't have the number there, but it's probably single-digit million people in the US. So there is a little bit of cannibalization, but the market is so much bigger. And also, insulin is becoming a little bit more genericized.
Yes. It's not really a direct Kodak sort of moment, but a little bit of cannibalization. prescription.
Yeah, which is pretty common in the pharmaceutical area.
Sure. Okay, fantastic. Craig, that's really helpful. Wrapping up, is there anything else that you wanted to add in that you think that listeners might want to take in mind when they're thinking about their wealth management and how these category of drugs, GLP-1, Ozempic, these type of things roll out?
I think we've covered most things, David. I guess the way that, just to summarise the way we're thinking about it, is that I think the market right now appreciates the demand pull from a lot of patients. Now, a lot of people demanding these medicines right now are probably doing it for the wrong reasons. But I think what the market probably still doesn't appreciate is just how much push there's going to be from doctors to get their patients on these medicines. You know, having practiced as a doctor in the past, I understand just how much of a headache obesity is to treat. It is such a huge risk factor for so many other illnesses. And doctors have really struggled to have any sort of treatment or effective behavioural change for it. So now there's a class of medicines which can significantly reduce this, you know, really highly problematic disease. And I think, you know, that's going to result in an uptake which, you know, still exceeds expectations out there.
Now, Craig, one of the things we have done as a bit of a thank you for people joining us on the podcast and giving us their time, their thoughts, and sharing those with our listeners is giving them the opportunity to plug a not-for-profit if they have one. So if you've got a not-for-profit you'd like to give a little shout-out to and a plug, please now's the best time.
Oh, thanks, David. So, yeah, a quick plug to Humanitix. So that was started about 5 years ago. A friend of mine in the industry, Joshua Ross, started that. It's a competitor to Ticketek, so it does ticketing. Mm-hmm. However, all 100% of its profits go to charity. So if any listeners out there have school events they're going to organise or club events or any events really where you need to charge customers a ticket, then you know, I think it's worth giving Humanitix a look.
And how do they determine what they're giving that to? Or is that done on a case-by-case basis?
Yeah, it's probably worth talking to Josh about that, but I'm happy to connect you up, yeah.
And what's the website, humanitix.com?
I believe so. So Humanitix.
Beautiful. Craig Holley, thank you for joining us Inside the Rope.
Pleasure, David. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Rope with David Clark. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can connect with David by visiting codacapital.com. Any views expressed in this recording represent the personal opinions of the speaker and do not represent the view of any other party. If this recording contains reference to any financial products, that reference does not constitute advice or recommendation and may not be relied upon. Listeners in Australia are encouraged to visit www.moneysmart.gov.au to obtain information regarding financial advice and investments.